Good afternoon and welcome to Beyond the Pale on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. I'm Adam Horowitz here with Lizzie Ratner, and we're filling in for Esther Kaplan while she's out on maternity leave. We have an exciting show today. We're going to begin with a discussion about Ron Paul, the Republican presidential contender who has not only been tearing up the campaign trail, but also shaking up the left. We're then going to talk to leading political scientist John Mearsheimer about the career of Dennis Ross, one of the central figures in the failed Israeli-Palestinian peace process. And finally, we're going to look at the myth of Barack Obama's quote-unquote Jewish problem. But first, Ron Paul.
When the Republican presidential race began nearly a year ago, few of us could have imagined that the fight for the Republican nomination would also become a battle over the priorities and even meaning of the American left. But that, in many ways, is precisely what has happened thanks to the crossover candidacy of Ron Paul, the conservative libertarian who's running second to Mitt Romney. With his strong anti-imperial pro-civil liberties platform, Paul has earned the ardor of such bold-name progressives as John Nichols, Robert Scheer, John Stewart, Alex Coburn, to say nothing of the masses of hyped-up young people. For other progressives, however, no amount of righteous foreign policy rhetoric can overcome Paul's anti-safety net, anti-civil rights, pro-free market philosophy, as well as its intimate association with the racist rantings of the Ron Paul newsletter. As Nation writer Ben Adler recently wrote, quote, "If liberals can't agree that opposition to civil rights disqualifies you from the presidency, what can we agree on?" It's a good question, one of many raised by Ron Paul's candidacy. And here to discuss this, as well as the broader meaning of the Paul campaign, are several thinkers who've been intimately involved in the debate. We're here in the studio with Ta-Nehisi Coates, senior editor of The Atlantic, as well as the author of the memoir, The Beautiful Struggle. We're also joined by Phyllis Bennis, a Middle East expert and activist, who directs the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, and is the author of 8 books. Welcome to Beyond the Pale.
Oh, glad to be here.
Great to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. I'm going to begin with you, Ta-Nehisi. You've written a number of critical pieces about Ron Paul, including one in which you tracked down Paul's vote against the creation of Martin Luther King Day, a holiday, of course, that we honor and celebrate tomorrow. What do you think? Is it possible to sort of separate Paul's positive contributions to the campaign, his anti-imperialism, his anti-war stance, from some of the very serious negative qualities he brings to the campaign trail?
The short answer is yes, and I think it's important to separate that out. I think, you know, you have to acknowledge up front, especially in terms of the drug war, in terms of where I'm coming from, there is no real national presence who will step forth and boldly attack the drug war, attack our current national security policy. So I think, like all other progressives, I get a thrill up my leg, too, to quote Chris Matthews, when I hear that. So I very much understand the appeal. I think the problem, just to set it out front, is to understand how those issues are tied to some of the same rhetoric that he boldly put forth in the 90s and defended publicly in the 90s. One of the big questions that's come up for progressives and for liberals is, why don't we have people on our side saying this? Why don't we have people on our side aggressively pushing these issues? Why are they off the table? But see, part of that is tied to race, because there's a long history of African Americans like Paul Robeson, like W.E.B. Du Bois, who've made those sorts of critiques, being tarred as traitors, being tarred as people who aren't American. There's a reason why Ron Paul is able to say what he's saying. And I think, unfortunately, part of it is tied to what he used to say in the newsletters.
Can you actually just expand on that point a little bit more? I think it's really interesting, and I actually haven't heard it articulated so much before. And I would also actually note that a lot of the people who are coming out now and supporting Ron Paul within the progressive community are sort of men and white folks. That's what you hear all the time.
Right.
So if you can kind of just expand on that point, because it's really interesting to me.
Yeah, and so because I don't want to make it about race, I think the gender piece really needs to be brought up. I think we really need to grapple with the fact that if Ron Paul were president, women in Mississippi might have a very, very big problem. Mississippi is a state where I think the population is one-third African-American. So we're talking about, if I can just talk in the most naked, selfish retail politics, we're talking about a large number of African-American, poor, largely, women in Mississippi who will not do well under a Ron Paul presidency. Look, I think you support whoever you support. We all have to make trade-offs and make arguments. Barack Obama is not perfect. I certainly have my critiques. You know, I certainly did my calculus when I supported Barack Obama. But I think if you're going to do that, you should be honest. You should be honest.
Yeah. Thank you. Phyllis, we want to bring you into the conversation here, too. The real catnip for progressives who are supporting Ron Paul has been his anti-war, pro-civil liberties position. But there does seem to be a slight but important philosophical difference between Paul's foreign policy and that of progressives. I was wondering if you could outline some of those differences for us and why those are important.
Well, I think there's a host of differences. I think given that Ron Paul starts from a vantage point of absolute non-intervention, what he calls, what he identifies as isolationism, I think we have to be very, very careful. One could make an argument that the impact of U.S. foreign policy on the people of the global South, on the rest of the world, has been so damaging, so devastating to people's lives, to any hint of economic equity, of economic justice, of stopping wars, anything, that the U.S. has played such a bad role in the world that anything it takes to stop that international intervention is worth it, no matter what the impact is on people in this country. You could make that argument. I think at the end of the day, it doesn't stand up, because I think there isn't consistency behind it. It's also a question of, if Ron Paul was president, do we really think that he could withdraw the troops from the 800 U.S. military bases around the world on his own without supporting Congress? Do we really think he could do all these things? I would argue, no, he can't. I think that his policy of isolationism also includes, even at the level of foreign policy, hugely contradictory positions. So, yes, he says that he would end the war in Afghanistan and pull the last troops out of Iraq. That's great. Now, what would he do about U.S.-paid mercenaries in Iraq, the 15,000 that are there now? Not so clear. Even on Israel, where one of the big issues for some progressives has been that Paul has said that he would not provide the kind of uncritical, unending support for Israeli occupation and Israeli apartheid that has characterized every other president since at least the last 40 to 50 years. But on the other hand, he has said things that are simply not true. He has said that the surrounding Arab nations, when he talks about Israel, the surrounding Arab nations get seven times the amount of aid that Israel gets. That's simply not the case. He defended the Israeli attack on the Osirik reactor in Iraq in 1981. You know, I think this is why we have to separate support for positions from support for candidates. Ron Paul comes with a commitment to ending wars, but he also comes with commitments against economic injustice, for states' rights, for economic policies that are completely skewed towards the rich and away from the poor. He opposes the United Nations, would pull the U.S. out of the United Nations, would not allow any level of foreign aid to any country. So, you know, the notion that he stands against the current wars is hugely important, and the fact that that position is being taken seriously and put forward in the context of a presidential debate is huge. But the idea that somehow that by itself, given all of the other negatives, is enough to support a candidate, I have a real problem with that.
I'd like to actually follow up on that point. We have a lot of young people right now who are really enthused by Ron Paul's campaign. And the sort of story out there is that it's his anti-war stance. It's his opposition to the drug wars. But in some ways, they're also being kind of marinated in the other policies, I think, you know, that he's espousing. Is there sort of a worry or a danger about a new generation of libertarians growing up out there? I mean, he is kind of injecting libertarianism in a big way into the national discourse right now, along with the anti-war rhetoric.
Absolutely. His anti-war stance comes out of his libertarianism. We should be very clear about that. It does not come out of internationalism. It does not come out of a position of respect for other countries. So I think that we have to be very careful in how we understand the basis of Paul's own positions. And frankly, I think that we have to be very cautious in how we assess what we think is the basis for the significant young the young cohort that supports Paul. I wish somebody would poll that contingent. There's lots of young folks that are, as you say, incredibly excited and enthusiastic about the Paul campaign. I'm more nervous about that, frankly, than I am excited, because I'm not sure what they are responding to. If it's all about his anti-war stance or his maybe his drug stance, that's fine. But I don't know. Are they saying that they don't care that he opposes the Civil Rights Act and opposes the Voting Rights Act? Are they saying they don't care that his view of environmentalism is what he calls free market environmentalism, that all solutions can only come from the market? Are they supporting him because he's anti-abortion and calls himself pro-life and says that he would leave those decisions to states, giving states the right to deny women rights? Are those the reason that he has so much support from young people, particularly young white men? I don't know the answer, and I don't know that there's been any polling done, but it does make me very nervous, because I think it's not as if Paul's economic policies and his isolationism and his libertarianism, with all its negative sides, are somehow sidelights, that he's mainly an anti-war figure and only on the side is he these other things. These other things have shaped what he believes, shaped his politics, even shaped his anti-war stance. So I think we have to be very, very careful here.
We're talking with Ta-Nehisi Coates and Phyllis Bennis here on Beyond the Pale about Ron Paul and some of the debate within the left on his run for president. Ta-Nehisi, it does seem that some of the people who are attracted to Ron Paul are really doing it from a place of being disappointed and disillusioned with President Obama. You've written sort of on both sides of that, writing in the Times, encouraging President Obama to listen more to his progressive critics, and then also sort of taking some of those critics to task, referring to them as Team Commie, and maybe in terms of having unrealistic expectations of the president. I'm wondering, does the progressive criticism of President Obama make sense to you? And within an electoral context, what would you suggest they do if they aren't going to be supporting someone like Ron Paul, who is bringing these criticisms? What's left for them?
Two quick things. I just want to make sure we're clear that Team Commie is an inside term I use for myself and the commenters on my blog. I don't want it to sound like one of these people who runs out and talks about the professional left and that. So it wasn't that sort of comment.
Okay.
It's a self-referential joke. With that said, I think the question you pose is an interesting one and is a complicated one, because the answer becomes, if not Ron Paul, then who, then what, then when? The answer to that question is not very satisfactory. If you look at, and this is just, you know, the thing that I've looked the most at, if you look at the drug war, a lot of this is about state laws and state legislation. So if you're really, really worried about the drug war, one of the best things you can do is organize on the local level and on the state level. In your hometown, the most, Ron Paul is saying he would pardon everybody who's imprisoned on nonviolent drug offenses. That's great to hear. That's great to hear. But a large part of this architecture is on the state level. I find that tends to turn people off, because those sorts of campaigns are dirty and they're quiet, and they tend not to attract the sort of attention that a presidential debate does. They tend not to be spectacular. But I really believe that a great deal of the work to be done is right there. And also, I think even on the grassroots, when California was trying to address marijuana, I guess maybe about a year or two ago, in fact, they found that it was hard to get support among African Americans. Now, it's a policy that I obviously support. But these are the sort of discussions that need to happen. I think the NAACP ultimately came out in support, too. But there was a lot of debate within the African-American community. I'm not sure that everybody in the African-American community thinks the drug war should be ended. I mean, I do. I obviously think that. But those are the sorts of conversations that need to be had, but they don't have the kind of spectacle that a presidential debate does.
I think that's a really important point. I want to just follow up on it again very quickly because, you know, I think a lot of people, you've written about saviorism and sort right. of the way in which people are looking to Ron Paul as a savior. And I think right. that happens a lot in American politics where we have these endless 18-month-long presidential election spectacles.
Right.
And the idea is that the president can do everything and change everything, and that's the only way to make change in this country.
Right. Right.
And what you're saying is that actually maybe the point is not to focus on the president as the supreme force of change, but
right.
to go out into our communities, into our states, and do the really hard work there. And so I think in some ways, you know, Ron Paul is a symbol of the failures of the left. I mean, the
right.
symbols of the failures of the left to bring forward a candidate who speaks to all of our beliefs and interests and values, but also a failure to really do the organizing at the local level, which would make the presidential campaign less important.
Right.
Can you talk just for a second a little bit more about sort of, I don't want to say the failures of the left, but maybe the ways in which the left could be stronger such that Ron Paul wouldn't pose such a, you know, wouldn't be such a force of heroism for us or for people?
Yeah, I think the example I always look to is the abolitionists who worked for 30, 40 years before they could actually put people in Congress, before they could actually have a president who was not an abolitionist, but, you know, nominally was opposed to slavery, definitely opposed slavery's expansion enough to provoke the South to succeed. But that was a lot of going around talking. That was a lot of newspapers. That was a lot of lectures. That was a great deal of frustration. I mean, if you just put it in the historical context of facing the great evil of slavery. Now, you know, I don't want to minimize the drug war, but it's not quite slavery of having to live with that for 30, 40 years before you actually get to the point where your goal succeeds. I think we have to think about this as a long-term struggle, something that happens in increments a little bit at a time. I hate saying that. I almost want to kick, because there's a part of me that's still young, right?
Yeah.
It feels bad even saying that. And I think the other thing is, I think when people stand up like Ron Paul with these messages that make us all feel good and make our heart go a flutter, I think it's very important to interrogate those people. So when Ron Paul was talking about how Martin Luther King was a hero of his, I kept getting all these tweets about how he had voted for Martin Luther King Day. We would all love to believe that. That would, you know, that would be a great story, make everything great. But he didn't. I mean, and these are facts. And we have to, you know, be rigorous and I think really be about facing facts.
Phyllis, we want to put a similar question to you. What is your feeling about what this sort of Ron Paul momentum means for the left? And I guess by that, especially around some of these international issues that he's talking about, is there an opportunity for the left in some of the attention that he's brought to issues around U.S. aid for Israel, around the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan?
Yeah, I think that there are some opportunities here. I think that the question of legitimizing a certain kind of discourse is very important. And I think the fact that the Ron Paul candidacy is taking place, if we talk about the Israel-Palestine question in particular, at a moment when the discourse shift has been absolutely enormous in the last period of time. We have seen over the last, say, 5 years, an incredible shift in the popular media, in the mainstream press, among members of Congress, not in votes, I'm not claiming that, but the policy has not yet shifted, but the discourse is amazingly different than it was, say, 5 years ago. The rise of new formations within the Jewish community, the rise of the lack of fear these days for people who once would not ever say a word of criticism of Israel, to now take it as a matter of course. When you have the Washington Post top reporter on Inside Washington writing a piece, Time to Rethink Aid to Israel, as if it was just an ordinary piece. When you have Salon.com writing a major piece on how the media consensus on Israel has changed, this is a moment when that transition is enormous. The U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation, the big coalition, which began in 10 years ago with six organizations, now has almost 400 member organizations across the country. That's a reflection. The role of the mainstream churches, the Methodist and Presbyterian churches in particular, taking up in a very serious way the question of whether they should divest from corporations who are profiting from Israeli occupation. That's huge. You know, so we're in the midst of this having nothing to do with Ron Paul, and then the Paul candidacy emerges and provides a whole new approach to putting some of these issues into the center of the presidential campaign. that's all very important. It's a legitimation factor in the context of this broader discourse shift. But again, I think that we have to be very, very cautious in how we see the links. Ron Paul certainly does not oppose U.S. support for Israel on the basis of international law and human rights. So I think that, you know, we don't welcome all kinds of support no matter where it comes from. We have to really deconstruct this and figure out what of it do we support, what don't we support. What does it mean when he doesn't want to send the U.S. abroad in militarily, but wants absolutely no restrictions on guns in this country, including machine guns? You know, this is a serious problem. So I think that, you know, this is a very challenging moment for the left. I think that we still, and I absolutely agree with my colleague about the limitations on presidential elections, that presidents are not all-powerful.
They can't make
they can't make a lot of the changes that we want them to make. And one of the issues we have to deal with very seriously is the lesser evil notion. You know, the lesser evil, there's an old saying, if you're about to drown and the water is up over your mouth, that last inch to cover your nose becomes very important. For me, one of the key questions between the two parties, when they increasingly look so connected and so identical, one of the key questions is who's going to be appointed to the Supreme Court. That's where you see a difference. And for me, sometimes that's almost the only difference that looks significant. And that becomes very important. But you can't have illusions that somehow that means that the candidate of that party is a reflection of the movements that we've been trying to build for so long.
Phyllis Bennis, Ta-Nehisi Coates, thank you both so much for being with us this morning. I would love the conversation to go on and on and on, but we're actually going to go to a short music break right now. Come back in a moment. Everyone in the audience, stay tuned.
I am known for sticking to principle and not flip-flopping.
Yeah, we need a good man for presidency.
I would guarantee that I would never abuse habeas corpus.
We want him to get the America we have to help with.
The freedom message brings us together. It doesn't divide us.
I'll say, Ron Paul is here, waking up people everywhere. Ron Paul is here, making people be aware. Ron Paul is here.
The freedom message.
Waking up people everywhere. Ron Paul is here.
Defending liberty.
Vote for the man, Lord, next year. There's a doctor in the house. Is there a doctor in the house? Is there a doctor in the house? Is there a doctor in the house? Well, Houston, we have a problem. We need Ron Paul to solve them. Houston, we have a problem. We need Ron Paul to solve them.
Principle, the moral principle is that of defending.
Welcome back to Beyond the Pale on 99.5 FM in New York. That was just Ron Paul is Here by the Three Shoes Posse. We're going to now go to a segment we recorded earlier this week with leading political scientist John Mearsheimer, discussing the career of Dennis Ross and what it means for the Middle East peace process and current tensions with Iran. You are listening to Beyond the Pale on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. I'm Adam Horowitz with Lizzie Ratner. And for the next 15 minutes or so, we're going to look back at the career of an American official who has played a hugely formative, and many would say hugely negative, role in the Arab-Israeli peace process. We're talking, of course, about Dennis Ross, the controversial career diplomat who helped guide U.S. policy towards Israel-Palestine and the Middle East more broadly for the last two decades. Though widely known for his pro-Israel sympathies, Ross was tapped by George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, and then Barack Obama to help lead their peace process efforts. In a 2008 book, Daniel Kurtzer and Scott Lazinski quoted a prominent Arab negotiator as saying, quote, "The perception always was that Dennis Ross started from the Israeli bottom line, that he listened to what Israel wanted and then tried to sell it to the Arabs. He was never looked at as a trusted figure or as an honest broker." This past November, Ross announced that he was leaving the Obama administration, where he had served as a White House advisor on the Israeli-Palestinian peace process and helped set policy regarding Iran. He is now working for the AIPAC-affiliated Washington Institute for Near East Policy. We're pleased to talk today with Professor John Mearsheimer about Ross's career and what his departure means for the future of the peace process. Professor Mearsheimer is the R. Wendell Harrison Distinguished Service Professor of Political Science at the University of Chicago and the author of The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy, along with Stephen M. Walt. His most recent book is Why Leaders Lie: The Truth About Lying in International Politics. Welcome to Beyond the Pale, Professor Mearsheimer.
It's a pleasure to be here.
We were wondering if we could just start off by having you tell us a little bit more about Dennis Ross. Who is he, and how would you describe his role in the administrations he served under?
It's funny. I actually knew Dennis Ross a long time ago when he first got into the security business. He and I graduated from college the same year, which is 1970. And he started his PhD work in political science at UCLA. And he originally worked on Soviet military policy. Of course, a few years after that, I began my graduate work at Cornell University, and I worked on NATO-related issues. But he quickly moved away from doing the Soviet Union, so to speak, and got deeply involved in Middle East affairs. And I think that the shift took place when he worked for the Carter administration and actually was a deputy for Paul Wolfowitz. And they put together a very important study that said the United States should pay more attention to developing military capabilities that could be projected into the Persian Gulf region. This was in the late 1970s. And then, of course, in the 1980s, he began to focus more on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict as a Middle East negotiator, especially on Israel.
Professor Mearsheimer, can you talk a bit more about Dennis Ross's role in the peace process? How did he help shape the direction of negotiations? Was his role generally positive, generally negative from your perspective?
Well, I think that he played a central role in trying to manage the Israeli-Palestinian conflict during the Clinton administration. Of course, he had been involved before that in the first Bush administration. That's George H.W. Bush. But it was in the Clinton administration where he really moved to the center of the process. I think it's fair to say that he was the most important person in that administration who was dealing with the conflict on a day-to-day basis. And then he played a similar role over the past 4 years in the Obama administration. At first, it looked like President Obama was going to confine him to the State Department, where he would work just on Iran and not on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But by the summer of 2009, when Obama was beginning to have problems with the American Jewish community because he was putting pressure on Israel, Obama saw fit to bring Ross into the White House and to help with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So there are now two administrations, the Clinton administration, which of course went over 8 years, and the Obama administration for the past 4 years, where Dennis Ross has been at the center of the decision-making process. By almost every account, he is the central player on the American side. And of course, what's happened here is that he's failed, or at least the administrations that he has served have failed, first the Clinton administration and now the Obama administration. So his record is definitely not a positive one. We can talk about how much responsibility he bears for what happened, but the fact is that Dennis Ross has not even come close to making peace happen between the Israelis and the Palestinians.
Why do you think that is?
Well, to be honest, I don't think it has that much to do with him. I don't think he's done a good job by any means. I think that he has, as Aaron David Miller said, acted as Israel's lawyer, which has not helped facilitate a settlement, for sure. But the fact is that the Israelis are in the driver's seat here, and the Israelis are not seriously interested in allowing the Palestinians to have a viable state of their own. This is really the key issue, whether or not Israel is going to decide once and for all to give the Palestinians a viable state. And they were not willing to do that during the Clinton years, and they have not been willing to do that for sure during the Obama years. So the truth is that even if Dennis Ross wanted to push the Israelis towards a settlement that gave the Palestinians a viable state of their own, he could not do that because the Israelis have no interest in that kind of settlement at this point in time. And given that the Israelis have no interest in that kind of settlement, no American president, whether Dennis Ross is in favor of a solution or not, is going to be able to put pressure on Israel. Barack Obama just does not have the power to stand up to Benjamin Netanyahu any more than Bill Clinton had the power to stand up to Netanyahu or to Ehud Barak. It's just not going to happen because the Israel lobby is too powerful in this country. So I think the principal reason, certainly not the only reason, but the principal reason that the Clinton administration and the Obama administration have failed to implement a two-state solution is because of the Israelis and not because of Dennis Ross. Now, this is not to deny for one second that the Israel lobby hasn't been an important player in the game, because it certainly has. The only reason that Israel is able to resist any form of pressure from an American president is because of the lobby. But that lobby is much bigger than Dennis Ross. So one has to be careful not to put too much of the blame on Dennis Ross, which is not to deny that he has not pursued peace in a very smart way, because he's tended to act as Israel's lawyer, which is not good for Israel and not good for the United States. But again, I think in the final analysis, that did not matter that much.
During the introduction, I had mentioned that, you know, since leaving the administration, Dennis Ross has returned to his position at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. When he left the Clinton administration in 2000, that he did the same thing then. And it just would appear that there's a revolving door between serving in the government and pro-Israel advocacy when working on the U.S. side of the peace process. I'm wondering if you could say a little more about what Dennis Ross's connection is to the lobby. They're not necessarily disconnected. And what this revolving door says about the U.S. role in negotiations.
Well, I think there's no question that Dennis Ross is a key player in the lobby. He and Martin Indyk, who is now at the Brookings Institution, played a key role in actually setting up the Washington Institute. And he has long been a key actor at the Washington Institute, which is clearly a pro-Israel think tank and a key part of lobby. He's also the head of the Jewish People Policy Institute in Jerusalem. And he clearly identifies, by all accounts, with Israel and with Jewish people around the world. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. For sure, the fact that he's so sympathetic to Israel is perfectly legitimate in the American political process. The real problem comes when you have a person like that who moves out of the think tank world and moves into an official government position and then pushes policies that are pro-Israel. And when Aaron David Miller, who worked with Dennis Ross in the Clinton administration, says that the problem is that both of them tended to act as Israel's lawyers, you know you're in real trouble, because you don't want American policymakers acting as Israel's lawyers. You want them acting as America's lawyers. But the fact is that someone like Dennis Ross is so deeply committed, he has such a passionate attachment to Israel, that he, I think, finds it very difficult not to be Israel's lawyer. Now, I would imagine that he sees Israel's interests and America's interests as being synonymous. So in acting as Israel's lawyer, so to speak, he would probably believe that he's acting as America's lawyer. Now, there are going to be instances where that is true because the two countries have synonymous interests. But in the final analysis, no two countries always have the same interests. And in those circumstances where Israeli and American interests are at odds, you want policymakers who are representing the American perspective and have no special attachment to Israel or to the Palestinians. You want people who can be passionate in their attachment towards the United States and no one else. And Dennis Ross is not the only one, by the way. Elliot Abrams would be another example of a person who has a passionate attachment to Israel who has worked in American administrations on Middle East policy. I would note in this regard, by the way, that when Michael Oren, who had dual citizenship, he was a citizen of Israel and a citizen of the United States, when he became Israel's ambassador to the United States, the Israeli government made him give up his American citizenship. And they did that because they wanted it to be clear to everyone that Michael Oren represented the Israeli government and not the American government. He was an Israeli, not an American.
You are listening to Beyond the Pale on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. I'm Lizzie Ratner here with Adam Horowitz. We are speaking to Professor John Mearsheimer about Dennis Ross, the controversial career diplomat who's played an outsized role in the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. Professor Mearsheimer, you've spoken eloquently and enormously helpfully about Dennis Ross's passionate attachment to Israel and his role in negotiating U.S. policy vis-a-vis Israel. But he's also played a very large role in setting American policy toward Iran. I wondered if you could talk for a few moments about what Dennis Ross's role has been specifically and how that ties in, if at all, to Dennis Ross's work on setting U.S. policy toward Israel.
It's very hard to say exactly how much influence and what kind of influence Dennis Ross has had on Obama's administration's policy on Iran, because we just don't have a lot of information at this point in time in terms of how the policy was formulated. But based on what we know, it's quite clear that Dennis Ross thinks it's completely unacceptable for Iran to have nuclear weapons. And it's also quite clear that he's deeply opposed to Iran acquiring a nuclear enrichment capability. It's very important to understand here that it looks to me like Iran has not decided to build nuclear weapons, but what they're doing is developing a significant nuclear enrichment capability. And that's something that they're allowed to do as signatories of the NPT, the Non-Proliferation Treaty. But the administration does not want them to develop a significant nuclear enrichment capability, because once they have a significant nuclear enrichment capability, it's a short step to weaponization. The Iranians can get very close to having nuclear weapons without breaking the rules of the game. And this has the United States and Israel very worried. So the United States is working hard now, not simply to prevent Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons, but to prevent Iran from developing a significant enrichment capability. The question is, how do the Israelis and how do the Americans think about this? This is a much more important issue for the Israelis than it is for the Americans. Many Israelis, and this is certainly true of Prime Minister Netanyahu, think that Iran is an existential threat to Israel if it acquires nuclear weapons. So the Israeli government is putting enormous pressure on the United States to prevent Iran not only from acquiring nuclear weapons, but from developing a significant nuclear enrichment capability. Now, the question is, where does Dennis Ross fit in here? It's very clear that Dennis Ross, who invariably shares the views of the reigning Israeli government, has been pushing hard to get the United States to put great pressure on Iran not to develop a nuclear enrichment capability, and certainly not nuclear weapons. And Dennis Ross has gone to great lengths to make it clear that the United States should use military force if economic sanctions are not enough. If we're successful and we don't have a war, Dennis Ross will look good. But the real problem that we face is that it looks like the Iranians are determined to build a significant nuclear enrichment capability. And the $64,000 question is whether we're going to let them or not. I, however, don't think to attack Iran is in America's national interest. I think it's not in Israel's interest either. Certainly in Israel's interest, and it's in America's interest, to prevent Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons. But if Iran decides to acquire nuclear weapons, it's better to let that happen and contain Iran than it is to launch a war, because launching a war won't solve the problem over the long term, because Iran will eventually develop weapons.
Professor Mearsheimer, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
It was my pleasure.
Welcome back to Beyond the Pale. I'm Lizzie Ratner, here with Adam Horowitz. If you open a newspaper or turn on the news these days, you're bound to come across a story claiming that American Jews are abandoning Barack Obama over his positions on Israel and hurtling headlong into the embrace of the Republican Party. With headlines like Obama's Jewish problem and why Obama is losing the Jewish vote, these articles take Obama's faltering Jewish support as fact and argue that he'd better change his Israel tune or face Jewish voters and donors' wrath. It's a persuasive story. The only problem is it's not clear that it's true. Here to talk to us today about the state and fate of the Jewish electorate is veteran political journalist Greg Sargent. Sargent writes the Plum Line blog at The Washington Post and has previously written for Talking Points Memo, The American Prospect, New York Magazine, and The New York Observer. Welcome to Beyond the Pale, Greg Sargent.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being here. Let's just dive right in. Are Jewish donors abandoning President Obama?
Well, it sort of depends on who you ask. As far as I can tell, and I've been trying to track this pretty closely, no major Jewish donors have publicly broken with the president, which, you know, alone is a pretty heavy blow to the Jews abandoning Obama storyline. That said, there are some reporters who are pretty good on these topics, such as Politico's Ben Smith, who have talked to people and sort of sussed out that there really is potentially a fair amount of doubt about his policies in certain segments of the American Jewish community. Whether that translates politically into anything meaningful, of course, is really unclear at best.
There have been some stories out there, I think in the Washington Post as well as the New York Times, saying that, yes, indeed, Obama's support is faltering among the Jewish electorate and among Jewish donors and supporters, but the economy is probably the most important reason, more important, say, than Israel. Is that something that you've encountered in your reporting?
Well, the thing is that the reporting that says that tends to be based on national polling that also shows a broader drop in his support across the board. And in fact, some analyses of this polling have found that the drop among American Jews is actually less than the drop across the board. So it's unclear whether that drop, even if it exists, reflects anything other than a broader souring on the president over the economy, as you say. The other thing is that American Jews really tend to not rank Israel all that high on their list of things that motivate their voting. I mean, obviously, that's a pretty gross generalization, but, you know, analysts have concluded that. They really care more about domestic issues, and clearly Barack Obama on domestic issues is going to be more in line with what they think than, say, the Republican nominee will be.
So two questions that come to mind. It seems like the story, which has been getting a lot of attention, the facts behind it are unclear, to say the least. I'm wondering, in the work you've been doing, who does it seem is behind the story that Jews are fleeing Obama? Although there have been several stories saying it's not true, the story persists. And why do you think so much attention has been given this story?
Well, I mean, to some degree, the story is being fed by Republican operatives. I mean, in fact, in these stories, they're regularly quoted predicting this desertion is going to happen. And, you know, I mean, the question becomes whether they're actually trying to feed a more kind of nefarious subtext than actually the story of Jewish voters abandoning Obama. I mean, it sort of seems like, you know, the story is meant to, without saying so, reinforce the idea that the president is, you know, somehow suspect when it comes to a democracy that I guess many Americans recognize to be similar as their own, to their own, in, you know, in a land where they're surrounded by hostile Arab nations.
Can you explain that a little bit more?
I mean, it's, you know, this is really at the level of speculation, but I mean, the Democrat abandoning Israel storyline has been sort of a perennial in just about every presidential election that I can remember. And, you know, it's meant to feed more general doubts about the Democratic candidate and their sort of intention towards, you know, towards American Jews and towards, you know, Israel, a democracy which is a lot like ours, I guess, in many ways, in a land that's surrounded by hostile forces.
And just to follow up a little bit more on that, you know, Jews are about 2% of the population. We're not exactly a huge voting force out there. Why so much attention being dedicated to this story? You know, you don't really see, or at least I don't really see that many stories about, say, Catholics abandoning President Obama or women abandoning President Obama or sort of other groups out there. So why the interest in Jews?
Well, I mean, it's a good question. I mean, I can't really tell you why it's been a perennial. It just seems to be one every single cycle. And by the way, it bears mentioning that the Obama campaign does take that possibility seriously. I mean, they have poured an enormous amount of effort into outreach to the American Jewish community. They've enlisted a whole bunch of surrogates. They're really pressing very hard to tell Obama's story to these voters in order to prevent desertions among them. And you know, the thing is that they would be committing malpractice if they didn't see this as a possibility that they should address. But it's something that they do take seriously as at least a possibility.
Right. Along those lines, one of the questions I have is if there's been any signs that this fear within the campaign has been affecting the policies of the administration. I was interested to see that you wrote a piece on September 20th specifically about the campaign's effort to redouble their efforts to hold on to Jewish voters. The next day is when President Obama spoke to the UN General Assembly, speaking against denouncing Palestinian statehood, a policy he had supported the year before. And then that position specifically is the number one talking point on the website that the campaign has set up for Jewish voters for 2012. I'm wondering, are there any signs that the campaign's fear of losing Jewish voters is helping to shape the administration policies when it comes to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict?
I mean, I don't think so. I think the place to really look is at the rhetoric. After Obama gave that big speech about the 1967 lines, which contained, I guess, one line in it about that topic, after that speech created an enormous blow-up, he went out and addressed this again. I believe it was at the speech to AIPAC, where he placed much more emphasis on defining his position, which had been misrepresented, by the way. And the other thing to keep an eye on is the degree to which they're pushing the storyline of Israeli-American military cooperation. The fear of losing Jewish voters is really manifesting itself in a rhetorical shift, I think, more than a policy one.
And actually, just to sort of a final question here, the question of voters versus donors. As I said a couple moments ago, the Jews are a pretty small electoral force. But Jews do make up a sort of significant portion of the donor base for the Democratic Party. And I suppose it's possible to say that Jews do play a big force, you know, are sort of a significant electoral presence in places like Florida. But what's at issue here? Is it votes? Is it donations? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I think it's both. I mean, I think obviously Florida is going to play a huge role. It's going to be a very, very close election there. Republicans are aggressively pushing the line that in places like that, you know, an erosion in Jewish support could make the difference. But it is also about donations. I mean, you know, this is going to be probably this election is going to be the most expensive we've ever seen. And as you say, Jewish contributors do make up a big part of the Democratic donor base. I mean, I see this sort of an across-the-board effort to A, try and chill donations to the Democratic Party, B, peel off whatever little bits of Jewish support they can get in places like Florida, and C, perhaps most important, to sort of, you know, push the subtext, which is that, you know, Obama can't be trusted when it comes to a democracy like ours, you know, in a place that where it's surrounded by hostile Arab nations. I really think the subtext is very important to understanding this.
And, you know, you said you've heard this meme many times before. Has it been successful, and will it be successful this time?
Well, I mean, it didn't recall that. I mean, I think there were very confident predictions that Obama himself would lose Jewish support in 2008. He didn't. I think the same was said of Kerry and Gore. They didn't. You know, it's a lot of this is to do with trying to create a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, if these folks push the idea that Jewish voters may be abandoning Obama, then people say to themselves, wait, is there a reason we should be? And so the idea is to create a self-fulfilling prophecy in which, you know, the thing they're predicting actually happens.
Thank you so much, Greg Sargent. That was very helpful. And that really does it for our show for this week's Beyond the Pale here on WBAI, 99.5 FM in New York and streaming live at WBAI.org. Thank you so much for joining us today for our first show together. Be sure to check out our website, Beyond the Pale, that's PALE.org, and stay tuned for Sheldon Walden and Walden's Pond up next.